The Reformation was an attempt to answer the most fundamental questions of life then, and those questions endure today.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Who is God? Who am I? Where is God found? What does God make of us? Who is Christ? What's the purpose of my life? Why does suffering happen? All those questions remain absolutely pertinent, and the answers that were given in the Reformation are absolutely relevant today.
You can meet and hear Pastor Matt Harrison making the case for the Reformation's relevancy at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, call 618-223-8385 or visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois.
There's a social justice super clause. In other words, all laws should be interpreted according to the demands and dictates of social justice.
You know, the feminists used to say the personal is political. And we should have listened to them when they said that because they meant it. And what they meant was that absolutely every detail of your life would become politicized and that they meant to get into your life.
What we find here revealed in Job is that the point of being a Christian is Christ, is knowing Him who is the Son of God, our Savior, our Redeemer, who shed His blood for us.
Homemakers in Indiana love Issues Etc.
I think some people probably were surprised. It was a surprise and, well, it was probably roundly criticized in the press when President Trump chose as the education secretary for his first term Betsy DeVos, a well-known advocate for school choice. People said, oh no, here we go with school choice. But as the opponents of school choice found themselves struggling with that idea, maybe they underestimated what school choice actually meant in the mind of the new education secretary. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, May the 26th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Joy Pullman's going to join us to talk about Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's recent statement about federal school choice. Later, Chaplain Craig Mueller will be our guest. We'll talk about the vocation of soldier and military chaplain. Pastor Chris Roseborough, in our regular Friday feature, will join us for This Week in Pop American Christianity. We'll talk about inspired exegesis, inspired Bible interpretation. Some claim that they're getting their interpretation of the Bible straight from God Himself in a special revelation. Then, since it's Friday and the end of a broadcast week, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. That's a game we like to play with our listeners where we play four sound bites from this week's Issues Etc. audio. And after you've listened to them, it's your turn. You give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and you vote for one of the four to be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. It will be your opportunity to win the LPR bundle package. That's an I Have Issues t-shirt, an Issues Etc. travel mug, pen, bumper sticker, and a notepad goes to the listener with the best vote for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Joining us to talk about Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's recent statement about federal school choice, Joy Pullman, mother of four children, managing editor of The Federalist, author of the new book, The Education Invasion, How Common Core Fights Parents for Control of American Kids, and a recent column titled, In Surprise Move, DeVos Resists Pressure to Nationalize School Choice. Joy, welcome back.
Thank you.
Were you surprised? You follow these things very closely. Were you surprised that Betsy DeVos decided and announced that school choice was going to be a matter more for the states and for parents?
Well, I was suspending my judgment in hopes that Secretary DeVos would do that, just because, you know, for a long time I've been writing about and researching and noticing the dangers to parent choice and to our liberties, our constitutionally protected liberties, of expanding and nationalizing control over local education and local schools. So I knew, you know, within the education reform world, you know, we're all talking to each other all the time. So, you know, everyone had, there's, of course, various factions. Some folks would like to see a nationalized school choice push, and there's lots of different ways to do that. And but other folks would not like to see that for a number of reasons. So we've been, you know, obviously all talking to the secretary and her administration and to each other about those sorts of things. And it really was uncertain which way she was going to go on this because, you know, we all knew that she supported school choice, but there's really a lot of latitude within that phrase. And so it's really hard to know that, you know, until you see actual policies like came out this week.
Does it indicate to you that she perhaps understands, at least in part, the dilemma of school choice nationally?
I mean, I think it does. She made a very clear statement on Monday. She was actually here in my home state of Indianapolis giving, you know, what was billed as a major speech. And it was reported that she was going to go ahead and announce, you know, a school choice program directed from the federal level. And she didn't go on to do that. But what she did go on to do was make some very strong statements about how parents and states not only have the right, but the responsibility and, you know, are best positioned to really make education choices for individual families and children rather than having the federal government. And she described it kind of this way. I'll paraphrase. She described it basically the setup that exists, you know, that allows the federal government to touch education at all, in which you have the federal government taxing money away from state citizens and then offering it back to us in exchange for us, you know, doing exactly what they want. So she called it, of course, bribing the states into submission. She said she's not going to do that. So that's really great to hear because, you know, that's basically, again, that's the basis on which her department operates, and it's used that kind of protocol to do a lot of really terrible things to American kids.
Has there been, to your knowledge, any reaction from either the advocates of a federalized school choice or the opponents of school choice?
Yes. I mean, so in public, the folks who want to have a national school choice program have been, you know, just the typical thing you would do on a press release. Well, you know, we're still going to continue, you know, to wait till Secretary DeVos sees the light, you know, and, you know, she might change her position. President Trump has campaigned on, you know, dramatic expansions in school choice, floating around the $20 billion figure. And he is kind of, you know, the sort of person who likes to do dramatic policies. So that's still, you know, that's still pending. Behind the scenes, I understand, you know, from folks that there's a lot of frustration among the folks who did want that to be happening right now. But of course, the people who, you know, want to have less federal and meddling in individual parents' affairs are really, really excited about the fact that, you know, she has decided to take this step, at least for now.
Why does it matter? Explain to us why just saying school choice isn't sufficient, that the devil is in the details and how it is actually implemented and who controls it makes all the difference.
That's absolutely right. I mean, so, you know, school choice is a poll-tested phrase that's really popular. So, of course, something that's popular, politicians are going to want to seize upon it and tell everyone they are for this really popular thing. But, you know, of course, I think what people, you know, who are polled mean just by the generic term and what politicians often mean can be very different things. You know, of course, just a basic, you know, normal person reading of it would suggest, huh, I get to pick what kind of school my kid goes to, what kinds of things are happening in that school broadly. You know, I, you know, as a parent, have broad latitude and kind of the primary authority over, you know, what's happening with my kids as they're maturing. But a lot of politicians, you know, people who deal with a policy, they like to use that phrase. It's kind of like, you know, that movie quote, you use that word, I do not think it means what you think it means. That's kind of what happens when you get bureaucrats involved. A lot of folks who say they support school choice really mean that they support themselves getting to tell families what their choices ought to be. And so a lot of the school choice programs that we already have in existence, such as the one I have in the state of Indiana, actually can often do the function of limiting parent choices by not only, you know, you have the state telling public schools what to do, but then also if you have a voucher program, you have the state telling private schools what to do. So this week, Betsy DeVos was also at a hearing in the House, and she was fielding questions about a potential national school choice program. And basically, Democrat lawmakers made it clear that they will consider it bigotry and discrimination if federal choice, any form of federal quote-unquote choice, goes to religious schools that uphold the orthodox, you know, teachings of all the world's major Western religions about human sexuality.
So it's not just about parents wanting to avoid certain curricular influences that you've obviously looked into a lot, like Common Core, things like that.
Right.
It's a matter of principle and really a matter of, could we even say, federalism?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the thing that we say in education policy, or any, you know, he who controls the gold makes the rules, right? So if you have the, at a state level, your state lawmakers being the ones who are in control of the education dollars that are going, you know, wherever is willing to accept them, you typically have more access to your state lawmakers, you know, than you're going to your federal lawmakers. Just in terms of representation, you know, the average congressman can sometimes be representing, you know, hundreds of thousands more people, you know, than even a state's governor sometimes, but certainly many, you know, to many factors more than a state senator or a House representative. So, the closer that you are to being able to talk to your lawmakers in person, then you are able to have better influence over them. Once you get up to the federal level, you know, look, you and I and moms and dads on Main Street, we have basically no power over what's happening in Washington. And so, when Washington is the one starting to consolidate and extend its authority over all the nation's public and now even private schools, if there were a national choice program, you know, then we basically lose the local control, the individual family control over what our kids are going to learn. And then it has to be negotiated among 350 million Americans, you know, the couple of hundred representatives that we have for them in Congress. And that's a recipe for anger. That's a recipe for mismanagement, you know, and just riding roughshod over individual concerns.
Why is it important for, when these decisions are being made, why is it important that we think long term, not just the next 3 years where it's likely there will be a Secretary of Education sitting in the Trump administration who is friendly and knowledgeable about the nuances of school choice, but think beyond this administration?
Right. So when Betsy DeVos was in the hearing on Wednesday, she basically kept saying, look, you know, I think that is a parent, that's a state, that's a local responsibility, to all these questions where members of Congress wanted to stick their nose in there and tell us what to do. But she kept, you know, basically standing up for self-government, you know, for local determination. And as you point out, that's really great for us. We haven't had that through the 8 years of the Obama administration. You know, I would say even with the George W. Bush administration, you know, we've not had education secretaries who are willing to, you know, return to say that you and me should be able to have major influence over what our kids learn in schools. But you know what? You know, President Trump will be president for maybe 8 years. And even if, say, magically a Republican is elected after him, you know, it's, who knows what kind of education secretary have. It could be a George Bush kind of command and control style education secretary. Betsy DeVos could decide, you know, she wants to retire from this job, you know. And as the seasons turn, inevitably we're going to have a Democratic president, and then we have a Democratic education secretary who wants to be telling everybody what to do. So given that that's the way things work in politics, we should be very, very careful of giving any control to folks at the national level, because even if someone is a good steward of it temporarily, ultimately, you know, someone that you don't like is going to be using all of that power for their own designs. And, you know, then you will wish you had not brought all that power up to the federal level in the first place.
Why at the classroom level, at the curriculum level, is it better for students if their parents are able to exercise genuine grass level school choice, as opposed to what people might argue is a more efficient and more easily coordinated kind of a school system run out of, well, out of Washington, D.C.?
Well, really what you're kind of contrasting here is the spontaneous organization of a free market, of a free society, in which, you know, the people who are closest to a problem are able to make the decisions about that problem. You know, in this case, the problem being how to get a child from immaturity to maturity, right? So always, 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 you know, on average, the moms and dads are going to be, they're going to know their kids much better than any, you know, bureaucrat can possibly know them. You know, you have a quote-unquote big family, 4 to 6 kids, say, that is way fewer than even just a teacher in a classroom is going to have to manage. And that's way, way more than the thousands that, you know, some bureaucrat's going to have to oversee. There's simply, you know, just in terms of numbers, there's no way that anybody else but a mom or dad is going to know each child so well. So that positions parents, you know, to be the best people able to make good decisions about that child. They have, you know, not only fewer kids to keep track of than any bureaucrat or even teacher, but they also have typically, you know, great natural love for their kids. Even though we all know kids can be frustrating sometimes, you know, we also know as parents that those kids, they get us in the heart somewhere that like nothing else ever does. And it's not this other kids, people's kids just aren't the same. So basically what you're contrasting there is kind of, you know, putting those sorts of people in the driver's seat, those people who have strong motivations on average to, you know, to be taking care of their own kids versus kind of a Soviet-style centrally planned economy. And you know what? Research and experience just shows that the farther, you know, even though it sounds really neat and efficient to have five-year plans and national plans and slotting people into, you know, the cogs in their giant machine, just in reality, human beings, we're not machines, you know. We require that sort of intimate touch that only families and local decisions can provide. And so treating us like cattle or treating us like robots really ends up, you know, hurting people and making them upset and really destroying their opportunities for a good and happy life.
I think the political motivation, you mentioned George W. Bush, behind something like No Child Left Behind. Well, the title says it, doesn't it? It says there are people who are falling through the cracks, families and children who are falling through the cracks. And so we need more federal control in order to keep that from happening. That's why it's there. It's essentially a safety net under the system rather than a control over the system. How do you respond to that?
So, you know, I do believe in just basic safety nets, right? We do need some sort of child protective services. You know, some mommies and daddies do abuse their children, right? So I'm all for that. But just because there's a couple of bad parents doesn't mean, you know, that all the rest of the parents have to be treated like abusive criminals. And, you know, if you treat all of the parents, you know, like the couple of bad eggs, then what you're, you know, you end up doing is making things much worse for the kids and for society. So, of course, I think that people have good intentions when they point to the most vulnerable around us. And I think we do all, we have an obligation, you know, to people who don't have, it's not kids' fault that their parents aren't treating them well, right? We owe things to them. But you know what? Again, the people who are going to be best positioned to take care of those kids, it's not going to be some, you know, caretaker, you know, government-sponsored orphanage. It's going to be, you know, the way that we do it now. It's going to be foster families. It's going to be neighbors. It's going to be extended relatives. You know, the people who are in their lives who have a motivation and a willingness to love and care for them individually. So again, you know, just because there are, you know, people who have bad life situations or aren't doing well, that's not really a good justification. You know, we haven't seen it work out before, you know, creating big giant plans for them. It, again, I call it kind of, you might have heard of that famous experiment in which I'm forgetting the name of the fellow, but what he did was take orphan monkeys and give them a wire mother and a cloth mother, you know, and basically the little monkeys preferred the cloth mother. Well, you know, we can give poor, you know, abandoned little children are the equivalent of a cloth mother, but or we can basically say, look, you know, we're going to try to give you the next best thing. We're going to give you a real family and a real society, right? So those are kind of our alternatives there, and I always want to pick the one that's going to be intimate and personal to children rather than great society plans that sound good but always fail to provide that love that individuals need.
I guess for some people it might just be a bottom line issue, and they'll look at the U.S. Department of Education with over 4,000 employees and a budget of, I think, approaching $70 billion for at least projected for 2017. They're just going to ask you, look, is what you are advocating here, Joy, going to be cheaper in the long run?
Well, yes. Yeah, of course it is. I mean, if we're just going to talk in terms of expenses, you know, there's this really great book. I actually was just this week in Chicago with the author of it, Vicki Alger. She's a scholar with the Independence Institute, and she wrote a book called, you know, Failure, the Miseducation of America's Children. So despite the kind of sexy title, it's a really research-full, you know, book that took her a decade to put together, and I don't know anyone else who has done the work that she has done, but it's a comprehensive case talking about how the trillions of dollars that we have given, you know, our taxpayers have given the United States to the U.S. Department of Education have overwhelmingly done absolutely zero to benefit American children. So our good intentions, you know, we're giving high funding to good intentions, but we're getting zero results. So we need to redirect those good intentions and all of that money in far more productive ways, you know. So we do know what doesn't work. And I even think that we know what does work. We have to stop, you know, the fuzzy brain thinking or just, you know, handing over our money to people who are using our emotions to manipulate us into giving them money to fund their cronies rather than actually measurably help any children.
Joy Pullman is a mother of four children. She's managing editor of The Federalist. author of the new book, The Education Invasion, How Common Core Fights Parents for Control of American Kids, and a recent column titled, In Surprise Move, DeVos Resists Pressure to Nationalize School Choice. You can read it this weekend at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Joy, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about the vocation of soldier and military chaplain on the other side of the break on this Friday, May the 26th. Chaplain Craig Mueller will join us of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Ministry to the Armed Forces. Stay tuned.
Children are a heritage from the Lord, but what of those who've not been given the gift of a child? The cross of barrenness affects not only childless couples, it affects the family, friends, and pastors who love and care for them. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm partnering with Emmanuel Press to publish the second edition of my book, He Remembers the Barren, a story about the hope and contentment found only in Christ, no matter the cross we bear. Visit emmanuelpress.us to learn more. EMMANUELPress.US.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. IssuesETC.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Parents, you know the church is persecuted even when you don't feel it or see it. But how can you prepare your children for a post-Christian world where that persecution is increasingly obvious? Read the May issue of The Lutheran Witness to learn more about catechesis, persecution, and why it's your job, not your pastor's, to train your children in the faith. Visit cph.org/try-Lutheran-witness for a special offer. $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.